Ramah, and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my guilt? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And he said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not true. It is not so, excuse me. But David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he thinks, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at the table with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan.' If he says, 'Good,' it will be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that harm is determined by him. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father?" And Jonathan said, "Far be it from you. For I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you. Would I not tell you?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you roughly?" And Jonathan said to David, "Come, let us go out into the field." So they both went out into the field. And Jonathan said to David, "The Lord God of Israel be witness. When I have sounded out my father, about this time tomorrow, or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed towards David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan, and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of his enemies of David from the face of the earth." And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies." And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul.
There is a word that we don't use too much in our culture. The word is covenant. And we use it from time to time, but it's not sort of prominent in our daily conversations. And if we were to say, you know, what covenants do people, human beings, that make, you might say, well, marriage would be the first thing that would come to mind. We sort of, at least some of us, still see marriage as a covenant. Some of you moved into neighborhoods, or you signed contracts or covenants that you would act in a certain way moving into this neighborhood. So we're sort of familiar with the word in that sense. But in the Bible, the word covenant is used throughout the entire scriptures, and particularly it's a predominant theme of the Old Testament. God is described as having a covenant with his people. He is in a covenant relationship with his people. And that covenant is marked by God's faithfulness and by God's love and by God's mercy and grace. And also it is marked by the obedience and the faithfulness of God's people. They live in relationship with each other. Now, David and Jonathan make a covenant. We read about that last week, and the covenant that they made is first described in chapter 18, verses 3, when Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And then Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor, even the sword and his bow and his belt. Remember, at that time in Israel, there weren't a lot of swords. There weren't a lot of weapons in Israel. The army just didn't have many things like swords. And so Jonathan gives one of the few swords in Israel, and he gives it to David. And Jonathan gives the robe that the prince of Israel would wear, and he gives it to David. And he honors David, and he enters into a covenantal relationship with David. But we don't learn much else about the covenant until we get to chapter 20. Then we begin to understand some of what's involved in this covenantal relationship. So what I'd like to do this morning is talk a little bit about this covenantal relationship that existed between Jonathan and David, and how that brings a picture to us of God's covenantal relationship with us in Christ. And I'm going to have, let's see, I have 4 S words for you this morning. So this will be an easy outline. 4 S words that describe the covenantal relationship. And here's the first thing we learn about covenants from this story. And that is that covenants are secure relationships where honest conversations can take place. Now, that's the first word. They're secure relationships. By the way, that's also going to be the last word that we're going to use, but I'll explain that in just a minute. In verse 1, of chapter 20, David basically is running away from Saul. Remember, we saw last week that there were at least seven different instances where David's life is directly threatened and David is in serious danger. And finally, David has to just run away. He can't stay near the palace or near the king at all. And so David flees to Naoth in Ramah, and David raises this question. He meets up with his friend Jonathan and he says, "What have I done? What is my guilt and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And Jonathan responds by basically saying, "Well, look, my father tells me everything that he does, and I happen to know that, and so from everything that my father tells me, my father doesn't really want to kill you. I'm sure you're, that's not the case." And David is like, "Nah, I don't think so. your father really wants to kill me. And what your father has done is he has sort of presented, he knows your relationship with me, and he's presented the situation as if he doesn't want to do me any harm. But trust me, your father wants to do me harm." Now, at this point in the relationship between Jonathan and David, there could begin to be an argument, right? Jonathan could be saying, "David, you have no idea what you're talking about. You're a fool. You're blind to the truth." And David could say, "Jonathan, you're an idiot, and you're crazy for not seeing it." And they could become angry or upset with each other. But that's not what happens in covenantal relationships. In covenantal relationships, you can have a discussion about anything and not get upset with each other, because you are committed to one another, and you're committed to discovering the truth, and you're committed to finding a better path forward. And that's exactly what David and Jonathan are doing. They're committed to discovering the truth and finding a better path forward, and so they're not upset with each other's position. And what Jonathan eventually says in verse 4, he says, "All right, what's your plan? Tell me what you want me to do. Whatever you say, I will do for you." And David says, "All right, well, let's have a plan to see if this is really true. Let's do a test to see if your father really does want to kill me." And here's the test. There's going to be a festival coming up very soon. It will be expected that all the king's court will be at the feast, but I'm not going to show up. So when I don't show up, if Saul is okay with the fact that I'm not there, then we'll know that everything's good. But if Saul becomes angry or agitated or upset in any way because I haven't shown up for this festival, then we'll know that Saul is out to get me. And that will be the sign that my worst fears have come true, that Saul really is out to get me. And Jonathan says, "That's a great plan. We'll go do that." And then they discuss some more details. "I'm going to meet you here in the field after that, and I'll give you the message, and that'll be the point." So that's the point. That's the plan. They because David and Jonathan love each other, they want to come to terms with this difficult situation. They want to come to terms with what's really going on and see how they can help one another. And that's the first thing we learn, that covenants are secure relationships. Now, there's going to be another instance at the end of this chapter that prove to us that covenants are also secure relationships. But for now, let's go on to the second point. And the second point is this, that covenants are serious promises. And the key word there is serious. Covenants are serious promises. In verses 12 to 13, Jonathan begins to state what the terms of this covenant are going to be, what the terms of their arrangement is. And here's what he says, "The Lord God of Israel be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety." Now, basically what he's saying is, look, however my father responds, I'm going to send you word. If he responds favorably, I'm going to send somebody out to meet you, tell you that everything's okay. If he responds unfavorably, I myself will come to meet you and will communicate the message to you. Now, Palmer Robertson, in his excellent little book, The Christ of the Covenants, describes a covenant as a bond in blood sovereignly administered. Now, I know that's a little technical, but it's actually a very good definition of a covenant. Now, a bond in blood sovereignly administered. Now, Palmer Robertson is predominantly talking about the redemptive covenants that we see throughout the scriptures. But it's worth noting that even this covenant that exists between David and Jonathan is a bond in blood sovereignly administered. When Palmer says that it's a bond, he means that it's a promise. That's what covenants are. Covenants are promises. I promise to do something. I promise to be a certain way. I promise to act in a certain way towards you. When Robertson says that it is a bond in blood, he means that it is a serious promise in which there are consequences if I fail to keep my promise. For example, when I was a little kid, we used to say, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. You know, do you ever say that when you were a kid? Somebody would accuse you of being a liar, of saying something that wasn't true. And you would say, no, it's absolutely true. Cross my heart, hope to die. And what you mean by that, at least I don't know if you understood it at that point, but you were taking a maledictory oath. You were saying, may I die if I'm telling a lie. May I experience pain and comfort if I am telling a lie. May horrible things happen to me if I am lying. That's what Palmer Robertson means by it says a bond in blood. In other words, a covenant is a promise that you are so intent on keeping that you would rather die than fail to keep that promise. It is a promise that is so serious that you would rather be inconvenienced, that you would rather be in physical pain than fail to keep your promise. A covenant is a serious promise. In the Hebrew, the word for covenant actually means to cut. In fact, if you translated it in Hebrew very, very woodenly, the covenant would be to Jonathan cuts a covenant. That would be a wooden way of translating that text. Because in the Old Testament and in antiquity, typically when two people entered into a covenant with each other, they wouldn't simply sign their name to a piece of paper. What they would do is they would go out into a field and they would slaughter an animal and they would shed blood. And then they would eat the meat or do whatever. But typically what they would be saying symbolically when they cut this covenant was, may what happened to this animal happen to me if I fail to keep my promise to you today. That's how serious the promise was. Now, I wonder, you know, how many people when they're at the altar getting married, you know, I wonder how seriously they think about the promise that they're making to their spouse on that day. What would happen if in our marriages we all understood that when we stood before our spouse and we stood before God and we stood before a congregation, what we were in fact saying is, I would rather die than break the promise I'm making to you today. I would rather suffer financial loss than break the promise I am making to you today. I would rather be unhappy than to break the promise that I am making to you today. What would happen to our marriages if we took that seriously, the covenant that we're making with our spouses? There wouldn't be a whole lot of divorce. Because I've heard lots of reasons why people get divorced, and most of them are you know, they're just inconvenience, their unhappiness, their pain, their difficulty, their hardships. But a covenant is such a serious promise that you would rather die than break the promise. So Palmer Robertson says that it's a bond in blood, it's a promise, sovereignly administered. And when he talks about being sovereignly administered, it means it's a promise that either God initiates, as in the case of the redemptive covenants, or it's a promise that God oversees, or God judges. What do you call the guy that when you write a will, you name an executor? That's what you call him. And the executor is the person who guarantees that after you're gone, that the details of the will be carried out. When you make a covenant before God, you are, in a sense, making God the executor. You're saying, God, I am looking to you to make sure that the conditions of these promises that I've made here are carried out. And if I don't carry them out, or if this other person doesn't carry them out, then may you do something. May you settle the score. May you act as judge and jury and pronounce sentence on either one of us if we fail to keep our promise. Now, this is exactly what Jonathan does here. If you look at the bond or the promise that he is making is that he will care for David and he will get word to David so that David knows what his father's intent are. I will send word to you if it's safe, and I will tell you directly if you are in danger. But either way, he's saying, I'm going to look out for your best interest. Jonathan then says in verse 13, and this is a little awkward language to read, but it says, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also if I do not disclose it to you and send you away. In other words, he's calling down a harm on himself. He said, may God judge me if I don't get word to you. May God be as harsh to me as my father intends to be harsh to you if that's the case, if I don't get word to you. And so he's saying, may God stand as a judge between the promises that I'm making today. So he brings this promise to David. It is a serious promise signed, as it were, in blood, and he's asking God to judge and to oversee it. That's why we say covenants are serious promises that are made. Well, here's the third point. Covenants, first of all, we're secure. Covenants are serious. Here's the third point. Covenants are steadfast expressions of love. Look what happens in verse 14 and 17. Then he goes on to say, Jonathan says to David, if I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of his enemies of David from the face of the earth. Now, some of your translations might not have steadfast love. They might have love, just the word love, or they might have kindness, or they might have the word affection. There is a Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is hesed, and the Hebrew word is typically translated as love or kindness or affection or something like that. But to get the full gist of what the word means, it means more than just love. It means more than just being affectionate or kind or nice towards someone else. It has a much deeper and richer meaning, which is why the ESV translates it as steadfast love, which is a good way to understand this verb. Steadfast love is something, you understand what love is. We tend to put love in an emotional definition, you know, it sort of has to do with the way we feel. But when you put the word steadfast in front of the word love, then all of a sudden love has a different sense to it, doesn't it? Steadfast means that love isn't going to change. Steadfast means that my commitment isn't going to change. My love isn't going to change, even though I might not feel good this morning, or even though I might be discouraged, or even though I might be depressed, or even though you might have treated me harshly the other day. My love for you is going to remain steadfast. My commitment is going to remain sure. And the Hebrew word has that sense to it. It does not merely mean love, as one commentator said, but it means loyal love. And it does not merely mean kindness, but dependable kindness. And it does not merely mean affection, but affection that has commitment. And so the word hesed has this idea of being, of loving a person, but loving them in a way that doesn't change, that is constant, that is steadfast through the ups and downs of life. Now, this word is often used to describe God's love for us. In fact, if you looked at Psalm 136 has the theme is the steadfast love of God, and it is described on just about on every verse, on every line. For example, here's the first couple of verses of Psalm 136. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love, his hesed love, endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord of Lords, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who alone does great wonders, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who is who by understanding made the heavens, for his steadfast love endures forever. And it goes on and on, the psalm does, to recount the history of Israel. And after every line, it's like the congregation would cry out, his steadfast love endures forever. See, you and I love, but our love is sort of based on what we had for breakfast that morning, or if we had indigestion, you know, or if we're in a bad, or if we're tired or fatigued, and our love sort of, it goes up and down in our relationship to other people. But God's love is not like that. God's love is like an arrow that cuts straight through the air, and it is consistent and solid no matter what our failings, no matter what the circumstances of life. Now, Jonathan understands this. Jonathan understands that if Saul is out to kill David, that changes the entire dynamic between Jonathan's family and David's family. Because all of a sudden now, Jonathan's family, King Saul and all of King Saul's family, will then become David's enemy. And David will be Saul's enemy. And as a result, there's going to be conflict. There's going to be a struggle between them. And Jonathan understands this. This is why Jonathan says, look, if this is true, if my father is out to get me, regardless of the circumstances of what my father thinks, may your love for me be steadfast. May your commitment to me, may the covenant that we make here today be a marker of our steadfast love, so that you will be faithful to me. And he says what he wants David to do. And Jonathan is really being prophetic here, because Jonathan is understanding that David is probably going to be the next king of Israel. And he understands what that would mean for his family and for his children. He says, if I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. See, what he's saying is, I know that if my father hates you, that makes me by default your enemy. But don't kill me, and don't kill my children. Typically, that's what happens with ancient kings, right? The way you secured your throne in the ancient world was that you killed off all the rival kings and all of his sons. That's one of the reasons kings had so many wives and so many children. They had so many wives and children so that it was hard for any rival factions or groups to wipe out their family, because basically that's what you had to do if you wanted to secure your throne. You had to wipe out all of your enemies, and your enemy was the guy who was king before you and all of his family. So wiping them out was a lot more difficult if you had 70 or 80 or 100 sons. That was a little more complicated to do. But that's what happened. And Jonathan understands that might be a possibility here. And so he asks for David to be faithful to him and to extend love to him. And if you continue reading the story, that's exactly what David does. David, despite the fact that he is battling King Saul for the rest of his life, when the end comes, David is looking for people to be kind, people from Jonathan's family that he can be kind to, that he can show his steadfast love to. And David eventually will keep this promise, even though Jonathan will have been killed in battle. So this is what steadfast love does. This is what covenants do, rather. Covenants root us in steadfast love. And as a result, they are great expressions of love to another person. Here's the fourth thing we learn about covenants, and that is that covenants involve sacrifice. What happens after David and Jonathan enter into this relationship, into this agreement? There's the next scene well, actually, they explain what their plan is going to be, and they have a complicated plan where once Jonathan figures out what's going on with Saul, he's going to go back, and he's going to meet David in the field, and he's going to pretend to shoot arrows at a target, and if he misses the target, that means that David's life is in jeopardy. If he hits the target, it means, well, it means that everything's okay. Anyway, they have this complicated system to work out. And they work all of that out. And then the next scene takes place where Jonathan is in the banquet room with his father. And that happens in verses 24 to 34. And in this particular scene, when Saul finds out that David is not at the banquet, Saul is furious. He is hot and upset because Jonathan has given David permission not to be there. And as a result, he speaks these words in verses 30 to 33. Let me read them for you. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." Then Jonathan answered Saul, his father, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. Now, if Jonathan had any doubts at all, this particular scene with his father would erase all the doubts. And Jonathan puts a great deal at risk in order to enter into a covenant relationship with David. Covenants are like that. They put certain things at risk. They force us to change. They force us to rearrange and set our priorities. And this is what Jonathan does. Here's what he puts at risk. He risks his relationship with his father. His father is the king. Most sons want to get along with their fathers. Jonathan knows that if Saul's going to be angry and Jonathan's going to be David's friend, that's going to create a great deal of tension between him and his father. It does. Jonathan puts that relationship at risk. He says, "My relationship, my covenant with David is more important than my relationship with my father." By the way, where have you heard that in the New Testament? Where have you heard someone say, "Your relationship with me is more important than your relationship with your father or your mother or your sister or your brother"? Didn't Jesus say that? Jesus said, "He who does not hate his father and his mother and his sister and his brother is not worthy of being my disciple." And this is what Jonathan faces in this relationship. His relationship with David becomes more important. Here's the second thing he risks. He risks his future as a king. When his father says to him, verse 31, "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established," that's really a true statement. Because God has already anointed David as the next king of Israel. And Jonathan seems to understand that. And Jonathan is okay with that. Jonathan doesn't mind that he's not going to be the next king of Israel. You know why? Because Jonathan says, "The kingdom doesn't belong to me. The kingdom belongs to God. And God can make whoever he wants to be king." Jonathan has an attitude and a heart of faith in this whole situation. And as a result, Jonathan isn't upset that David might be the next king of Israel. He's actually a little excited because David is a great man of faith. But Saul is right, and Saul is right in that Jonathan will never be king. But Jonathan doesn't care about that. He cares about his relationship with David, but he doesn't care that he's not going to be king, but he's willing to put it at risk. He's also willing to put his life at risk. Now, I don't know if he realized this going into it, but Saul becomes so angry that he hurls his spear at Jonathan, just like he did with David, and he tries to pin his own son to the wall. That's how angry Saul is, and that leaves no doubt in Jonathan's mind that Saul is out to hurt him. See, here's the thing about covenants. They often involve sacrifice. You know, if you get married and you don't come into the marriage with an attitude of, you know, "I'm going to have to give up some things. I'm going to have to rearrange some priorities in my life. I'm going to have to put things in a different order." You're going to have a really difficult marriage. I got to tell you this, because marriage is one sacrifice after another. Now, it's a sacrifice for the greater good. It's a sacrifice even for a greater joy. But it's not a simple thing, is it, to enter into a serious covenant where you would say, I would rather die than break the promise that I'm going to make to you. But that's the nature of covenants. When God made a covenant with Abraham, for example, back in Genesis chapter 12, God says to Abraham, Abraham, I want you to go into a land that I'm going to show you, and I'm going to give you that land. Everywhere you walk, I'm going to give that land to you and to your descendants. And I'm going to make your name great, and I'm going to make you a blessing to all of the nations. But Abraham has to do something. Abraham has to leave his family, and Abraham has to go to the land. You can't inherit a land that you've never been to. Well, I guess you could inherit a land you've never been to, but how can God give you the land if you actually don't leave where you are and go somewhere else? You know, the covenant involved some sacrifice on Abraham's part. Now, it was a sacrifice for the greater good, but nevertheless, Abraham had to give up some independence. Abraham had to give up his own agenda. Abraham had to give up his own plan, and that's the way with covenants. If you want the joy of the covenant, if you want all the fullness that the covenant has to offer, you have to be willing to put things at risk. Jonathan was willing to put things at risk. His relationship with his father, his future as king, and his life itself was put at risk, but that's the way covenants work. Covenants involve sacrifice. So covenants are serious promises. Covenants are steadfast expressions of love. Covenants involve sacrifice and commitment. And I want to reiterate the first point again here as the last point, and that is that covenants are secure relationships. Not only where we can have honest conversations, like I said earlier, but covenants are secure relationships where peace reigns amongst chaos or amidst chaos. Covenants are secure relationships where peace reigns amidst chaos. Jonathan rushes back to the field where David's waiting to hear word for him. Jonathan goes through the motions of the plan that they had originally arranged. He pretends to be shooting some arrows, and he does this so if anybody's following him, they'll just think, oh, he's shooting arrows, no big deal, and they won't pay much attention to him. But anyway, he goes out and he shoots a few arrows, and finally he sends his armor bearer away, and he and David are alone, and they have this conversation in verses 35 to 42. But the conversation begins in verse 41. As soon as the boy, his armor bearer, had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times, and they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever. And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went to the city. And that's the last time David sees Jonathan. They say their goodbyes, and it's an emotional moment. But Jonathan says this rather strange thing in verse 42. He says, go in peace. Now, Jonathan's not naive. He knows what this means. He knows that what this means is that from here on out, there is going to be war between Saul and between David. And Jonathan knows that he's going to be caught in the middle of it. So how can he say to David, David, go in peace? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, my dad's going to be after you. He's going to try to kill you. He might come pretty close. He might kill some of your family. He might do horrible things. You might spend the next 10 years of your life running from my father, which, by the way, he did. But he says, go in peace. How can you have peace in the midst of a chaotic lifestyle where you're going to be on the run from the most powerful man in your nation? How can there be peace in the midst of that? Jonathan says, go in peace, and he tells us why. Why? Because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between us. You and I have made a covenant with each other, and therefore you and I can be at peace, regardless of what else is going on in the rest of the world. I don't know if that's true for your life or not, but you know, for me, the most important things in life have to do with my relationships with other people. Are those relationships in a good state, or are they in an uncomfortable, an awkward state, or are they in an antagonistic sort of state? And the higher you turn the temperature up, the more distressed or the more restless or the more sleepless I become. Isn't it true that the most difficult situations in our lives are when the people we care about the most, when we are not, or rather we're not getting along with the people that we care the most about with? Those are the things that cause us restlessness, sleeplessness. Yeah, there might be all kinds of other chaotic things going on in the world, but if you and your spouse aren't getting along, or if you and your parents aren't getting along, or if you and somebody who means a great deal to you aren't getting along, you are under a great deal of stress and anxiety, isn't it? The greatest thing that brings us peace is when we know that these relationships that we have with other people are firmly fixed and solid, and they will not move regardless of what else goes on in the world. I can deal with a whole lot of chaos in the world as long as the people who have committed to love me remain faithful to me and remain loving to me. But if people remain unfaithful, you know, if there's unfaithfulness in relationships, then all of a sudden things become very difficult. So Jonathan says, look, you and I can be at peace, even though our worlds are going to be a chaotic mess. You and I can be assured that we can be at peace because we have made this covenant with each other, because our steadfast love will bind us together. See, the security of the steadfast love, that's the real blessing of the covenant, isn't it? The idea that there is someone who will love you no matter what stupid things you do, no matter what foolish things you might say, no matter what mistakes you make, no matter what disaster occurs in your family or in your home or in your world, there's someone there who's going to love you, who's going to be at peace with you, who's going to encourage you, who's going to support you, who's always going to be faithful to you. This is why the most important relationship that we can have is with the God who created us. And if that relationship could be at peace, nothing else that happens in our lives would matter, would it? As long as we had peace with God, as long as we knew that God would accept us no matter what, as long as we knew that God would forgive us when we failed, as long as we knew that God would continue to encourage us and support us and to build us up and to provide for us and give us all we need, regardless of what else was going on in the world, if we just had that, we would have something worthwhile, wouldn't we? And Paul reminds us in Romans that since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. You know what ultimate security is? Ultimate security is being in a covenantal relationship with the God who created you. That's security, because that by itself is the definition of peace. You may have nothing else in your life that is going right, but if you know the God who created you, and you know His steadfast love is on your heart and in your life, nothing else matters. That is ultimate security. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword, or you could go on and on and on. Nothing shall separate us from the love of Christ, which means that it is possible within the nature of a covenantal relationship with God to have peace. See, this is what covenants do. Covenants bring security. They bring steadfast love. Oh yeah, they involve sacrifice, but they are serious promises that will never be broken. The Bible describes the nature of our relationship with Jesus as a covenantal relationship. In fact, Jesus, on the night He was betrayed, took bread and wine, and He lifted it up, and He said, "This is the new covenant in My blood." See, every covenant needs a symbol. Every covenant needs a sign. When you got married, you probably exchanged some rings. You might have also signed some papers, but you exchange rings as a sign, a token of your relationship with each other. Every covenant has a sign. And the sign that God has given us of the new covenant in His blood is the Lord's Supper, the thing that we're going to observe this morning. This is a reminder that God has given us, has a bond in blood, sovereignly administered, to quote O. Palmer Robertson. That God has made a promise to us that He is so serious about, that He is willing to shed the life of His own Son. He is willing to bleed and die on a cross so that that promise will be kept. That's how serious his promise, that's how serious his covenant is with us. And God himself allowed this to happen. He assured that it took place. God's covenant with us is made secure because he was willing to pay the penalty that you and I deserve. And so as a result, we have a relationship with God. We have peace with God. Hebrews 9 says, if the sprinkling of defiled persons with the blood of goats and bulls and with the ashes of a heifer sanctifies for purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our consciences from dead works to serving the living God? Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. Is God's covenant with us serious? You better believe it's serious. He was willing to pay the ultimate price for it. Is it steadfast? Is there a guarantee? There's a reason why this covenant is called eternal. Because God's love is eternally steadfast. It will not change no matter what happens in this world. Does God's covenant involve sacrifice? It certainly does. Does it involve security? It involves security throughout all of eternity. This is what you and I have if we have entered into a covenant relationship with Jesus Christ. And if we have entered into that covenant relationship with Jesus today, he's going to invite us to be reminded of that by partaking of this Lord's Supper. So as we prepare our hearts to do that, let's pray.